Coming up, surging innovation and savory snacks, the evolution of sensory science, and putting a positive spin on food science. It's all ahead on episode 31 of Omnivore, from the editors of Food Technology Magazine and the Institute of Food Technologists.
This episode of Omnivore is brought to you by IFT's Global Food Traceability Center. Get ahead of FDA's Food Traceability Rule compliance deadline with the Enterprise Traceability Education Suite, your unbiased source for comprehensive traceability training. Learn more at ift.org/traceability.
Welcome to Omnivore from IFT and Food Technology, where we explore the intersection of business, science, and technology in the global food system. I'm Bill McDowell. Over the last decade, we've watched a spike in development of packaged, better-for-you savory snacks, with both startups and large corporations introducing new products in the space. And the trend doesn't appear to be slowing down anytime soon. Food Technology's Kelly Hensel spoke with Amy Marks-McGee, founder of consultancy Trend Insight, to discuss the drivers behind the growth of alternative snacks, where the category is headed in coming years, and finally, what exactly is a meat chip?
Thank you for joining me today, Amy. We're going to talk all about snacks and in particular alternative snacks. And I was wondering first, what are alternative snacks? Like, how would you define them?
Thank you for having me. So I think that alternative snacks should be defined as better for you, healthier snacks that use a variety of ingredients such as vegetables and pulses, but they also use alternative methods to frying such as baking.
And why do you think this category is growing so much?
I see the category growing for a few reasons. Well, first, consumers are seeking to incorporate overall health and wellness into their lifestyles. And there's been a growing demand for better for you and better for the planet-based products and foods and beverages in adjacent categories. And now that consumers are seeing it in adjacent categories, they're now expecting it to have these alternative products in the snack segment. I also think that snacking, we know that snacking is embedded in our consumer behavior and our culture. And I feel that the pandemic just propelled that behavior. So people are continuing to snack at home. And lastly, in addition to snacks that are formulated to be better and healthier for you, such as reduced salt, sugar, and fat, consumers are now looking for functional ingredients in their food and beverages, such as vitamins, the fiber, protein, probiotics, and more activity we're happening to see in adaptogens.
As I was reading the article, I started to wonder, and I wanted to get your input. Do you think that as a large established brand, let's say like Frito-Lay or, you know, some other company like that, is it harder for that kind of company to debut a healthier new variety of snack than say like a new startup or indie brand that has like health as its main premise?
So I think that it really depends on the company, but generally speaking, I think it might be a bit more challenging for these larger established brands to debut healthier snacks due to their size and their history. And I also think that consumers don't necessarily expect large snack brands like, say, Doritos or Pringles to be healthy snacks. So I think the more popular trend is for these larger established brands to acquire these indie brands. And I feel that the indie brands are taking the risks and they are first to market to launch these better for you, healthier snacks. And once they've been proven, then they start become market leaders within that segment, or they have a proven consumer demand, then the larger established brand acquires them. And then with the acquisition, they can help grow that indie brand into, you know, with all their resources. I think a good example is maybe the 2019 Pepsi acquired BFY Brands Inc. And that's the snack company that makes the popcorners. And I really think this trend is going to continue. Because it's easier for a big established brand to buy an indie brand and acquire them than to start from scratch.
In the article, you mentioned the rise of meat chips. And I was just curious as to what is that? And it's a relatively new concept to me. So I was hoping you could provide a little more info on that and give our listeners an example or two.
So meat snacks are actually just meat-based proteins such as beef, chicken, and pork. And they're snacks like chips, jerky, and bars. And I think that it really started emerging in 2019 because it was being driven by the paleo and whole 360 lifestyles and diets. And so I can give you a few examples. One of the more recent examples is Tony B's steak chips. And they describe themselves as taking the best parts of beef jerky and the snackability of classic potato chips and putting them together in a meat chip. And the steak chips are made from premium beef and they come in four flavors. It's a coconut curry, a gochujang, Szechuan peppercorn, and teriyaki. Another example for chicken is Epic Provisions, which is actually a subsidiary brand of General Mills. They offer chicken crisps in cracked pepper and pink Himalayan sea salt varieties. And the crisps are made with baked chicken breast, coconut flour, and spices.
As you describe those product examples, they actually sound pretty delicious. I was kind of surprised because when I hear meat chips, I'm not necessarily inclined to pick up a bag. But actually, that sounds really, really yummy.
Yeah, I think that people that like beef jerky or those type of textures or like meat, like bars, might enjoy those kind of beef snacks.
So what's next for alternative snacks? Where do you see the category expanding in, say, the next 5 years or so?
So I think that consumers are going to continue to expect and almost demand, it's just going to be second nature, that these snacks have cleaner formulas with functional ingredients, and that they have some kind of added benefits, you know, such as these mood boosting benefits. I think we're going to start seeing more products that are better for the planet and they use sustainable packaging and ingredients, as well as sustainable practices to produce those products. I think that protein is going to continue to be a focus for alternative snacks, both animal-based and plant-based proteins. And we know that in general, snacks are replacing meals. So I see this continuing, and perhaps the snacks are going to become more substantial and sophisticated, maybe through technology or AI in the next few years or so.
Yeah, that I can see that coming for sure. And it's so interesting because I actually had snacks for dinner the other night. I just realized I had what we call beer sticks around here, which is just like a meat stick, basically, and then some cheese cubes. And I was like, oh, look at that.
Yes,
I definitely for dinner.
Yeah, I definitely think, I mean, people are using snacks to replace meals. And I think as time goes on, that behavior will continue. So I feel like the snacks are going to be more substantial. They might still be small and snacks, but maybe the content in them is more nutrient dense or nutrient rich that will replace a meal.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today about all these yummy snacks.
Thank you, Kelly. I appreciate the opportunity.
Amy Marks McGee, the founder of creative consultancy Trend Insight, has more than 25 years of experience in the flavor and fragrance industries. You can read more about the latest trends in alternative snacks in the March issue of Food Technology. We'll be back with more Omnivore in a moment, but first, this word from our sponsor.
Empower your business to reduce the negative impacts of recalls with IFT's new one-stop resource, the Enterprise Traceability Education Suite. Known for its impartiality, IFT's Global Food Traceability Center developed the comprehensive Enterprise Traceability Education Suite as the only education solution designed to quickly help get your entire organization up to speed on key traceability concepts. Get practical steps to designing an effective and cost-efficient traceability program. With IFT's Enterprise Traceability Suite, you save valuable time and money in preparing for FDA's traceability rule, January 2026 compliance deadline. Find out more at ift.org/traceability.
Welcome back to Omnivore. I'm Bill McDowell. Sensory scientists measure and interpret how people perceive the world around them through the lens of sight, smell, taste, touch, and hearing. As you'd imagine, this has a big impact on how a consumer will respond to a food or beverage product. Like most scientific disciplines, sensory science is constantly evolving. In this segment, sensory scientist Dr. Danielle Van Hout talks with Food Technology's Mary Ellen Kuhn about how this multidisciplinary field is changing and why it's as important as ever to food innovation.
Danielle,
Michelle, you're a sensory science professional. Do most people really have any idea what exactly your role involves?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And I think also there are so many different roles that a sensory science professional can have in industry, in academics, in market research agencies. It can be very different functions, but what makes them special is more the skills. Sensory scientists have skills in terms of perception, how perception works at three levels. So how does it work? What are the mechanisms in the brain, with the senses, but also how you measure it in the best way? So how can I ask the question, how can I set up a good, robust test design? And finally, how to do the analysis of the study. And that all related to each other. So sensory scientists it's the skills what makes them unique, and they can be in many different roles.
Well, one of the themes that emerged in your food technology interview was that sensory science builds bridges with other departments, marketing, product development, and quality. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how that works and why it's important.
Yes. So from the past, from the beginning, sensory has been always the partner to product development. It was located in R&D, and it helped product development with the input from the panel, how they could improve their products. But also for marketing, sensory data is very important because they also work with the products and the brands. So the sensory data will also help to see whether the product meets the expectations that the brand already creates in a way, with the advertisements. And then in quality, of course, sensory is key because you need to know how far you can deviate from your golden standard before people start noticing or before it becomes a problem. So all those different disciplines require sensory data as input. And that makes sensory really the bridge between product development, marketing, and quality.
Well, one of the things that I learned reading the article is that while in the past sensory analysis focused primarily on hedonic responses such as liking, it can do much more than that now. So could you talk a little bit about how the discipline has evolved and its capabilities have expanded?
Sure. Yeah. So in the past, indeed, it was a lot about measuring liking and sometimes in the lab only. Yeah. So that product completely out of context and then asking a hedonic response. Also, what has been from the start, sensory has been these trained panels with descriptive analysis who evaluated also in the lab products on all kinds of attributes. What we now see more and more is that the whole context around it is so much more important. So having the context either described or having it in their home situation being tested, but also the measure of liking turns out that it's a very instant measure of this moment. So do I like it? Maybe next time I don't like it so much. While what we're actually after, we want to know something that is predictive, whether people want to buy it again. So satisfaction is, for example, a much better measure because that tells you how it fits with what people expected. So we learn much more about the whole context, how important that is. And you even see that in companies that they now don't call it anymore sensory departments, but it's much more about user experience or customer experience, so that also the usage of the products, the purchase of the product, everything is taken into account, also in the sensory field. And I think that's very much needed because liking in isolation doesn't say so much.
That's a great explanation. Thank you for that. Well, you're the president of Igora, a consultancy that works to help sensory and consumer science teams at CPG companies leverage the power of artificial intelligence. So from a very top-line perspective, what are the opportunities that artificial intelligence offers in the sensory discipline?
There are some easy wins. So for example, everything that you do routinely can be automated. And what you see is that saves so much time. One of our clients once said, it's like we have six new people in the department. Because normally people do a lot of studies and there's a lot of turnaround time to analyze it, to report it. So that is the first win. And then, using all the data that you have in knowledge bases so that you don't all the time need to test again and can learn from all the previous historic data that you collected. And from that data, you can also build models so that you don't need to test everything again, and that you sometimes can do a lot of screening using the models and then only for the final test go to the consumer. So in that sense, you have a lot of data at your disposal, you save enormous amount of time, and you make the job more interesting for the people involved. Because yeah, we are taught in the universities and everywhere to use our brains and to find insights. And then we end up being project managers, having a turnaround of many projects throughout the year, while we lack time to really look for insights. And I think that's the biggest value at this moment. Yeah.
Well, on the flip side, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what the limitations of artificial intelligence are in the sensory science area.
Yeah, so there are a lot of opportunities, but indeed also limitations. And what we see is that when we are working with the data, and companies have mass amount of data, sensory data, consumer data, also market data from consumers from social media. But when we start working with it, we see that sometimes it's very difficult to integrate data because every study has a different approach, different questions. Sometimes it's not captured what the products were or what the differences between the products were. So in the end, there is only a small amount of data that we can reuse in these models and in these knowledge systems. So what we often do as a second step already is to look at how do they do the things? And then comes back our science skills. Do we measure the right thing? Can we make the scale more universal because my company is in more countries? So can we make sure that that connects? All those kind of things. So once you know what you have now, you might want to look at, can I do it in the future better so that every study that I do also brings value for the future, not only for my immediate need? And that is what I see. People sometimes, I think a bit too easy about, oh, I have this whole can of data. Let's put it in a database and then we can get value from it. But unfortunately, our data is quite complex and sometimes very messy also.
So those basic sensory science discipline skills are still very important.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that is also why I think that everybody can do sensory without having an education. And that's what you often see. Yeah? And I think it also came into that other interview. People all taste. We all taste. We all evaluate products. So a lot of people think, oh, then I also know how to measure it. But in order to measure it in the right way, you need to understand how our brain works and what are the pitfalls. So if I taste a strong product and after that a weak product, yeah, that weak product will be much weaker than it normally is. All those things happen with all the senses.
So it's complicated.
It's complex. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what do you foresee for the future of sensory science that you're really particularly excited about?
The most excited I'm about this whole area of VR, you know, those virtual reality, the new glasses and everything that are coming out are amazing. And I think all that area, also the metaverse, who's now really starting to happen. And I know it sounds like far-fetched, but I see it's coming quite fast. And especially for consumer research, we talked about context. But of course, if you can make a context, create a context in people's whole lab, which looks really like the shopping situation or whatever, it will give a lot of more realistic data, I think, in the end, it will give us. Yeah.
Danielle Van Hout is president of sensory science consultancy Agora. Check out the March issue of Food Technology to learn more about what she and other prominent sensory scientists have to say about their evolving profession. It's no secret that the global food system faces its share of challenges right now. From kinks in the supply chain to public distrust around health and wellness promises. Yet at a time when the need for sound science has never been greater, it's increasingly difficult for experts to cut through the noise of misinformation and build trust with the public. I recently spoke with consultant Kantha Shelke, who suggests that scientists should take a more positive approach if they want to flip the conversation with consumers. Kantha, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Your recent dialogue essay, touches on a recurring frustration that I certainly hear a lot among your peers in the scientific community about misinformation and ignorance about food. And you wrote that this disconnect is actually hampering innovation. Explain what you mean by that.
It all comes down to trust. Trust is the foundation of almost everything we do, and certainly what and how we eat. When we look at what's happening today, the growing market distrust of what is in our food, it is also a growing condemnation of the stakeholders across that value chain. So it's time for us food scientists to take charge and to help the food industry, the media, influencers, and ultimately consumers understand the science and sensibility critical for what's truly healthful to the consumer and because of their interest for the planet at large.
What do you think is at the root of this disconnect between the information that's being provided and what's actually being received?
I think it's actually a communication issue, which is why miscommunication, misinformation. So we may say it like a food scientist, and as we help people understand a new technology, we talk in terms of the technology and what it does. If we talked in terms of the benefits for consumers or to the planet, then it resonates with consumer needs and expectations, and therefore helps them accept what we're doing better. When we always talk in terms of yield, in terms of drought, you know, drought resistance, et cetera, every consumer is looking at it and saying, what's in it for me? It just means it's all about you. I think that's a big one. So understanding stakeholder perspectives is a very important issue. So when we have a new innovative technology, policymakers often come and hamper progress a little bit because they don't get it. So industry representatives and the community leaders, if we could understand their perspectives, their concerns, and most of all, their values regarding that food innovation, then through an open dialogue, we can actually identify those shared values and talk about the food against the backdrop of those aspirations.
In the article, you suggest shifting the conversation about food toward an appreciative inquiry approach, which focuses less on solving problems and more on amplifying positives. Expand on that. What exactly is appreciative inquiry, and what does it mean in practical terms?
So the theory of appreciative inquiry is the ability to see the mighty oak from the acorn. Best said. So in other words, the ability to adopt a growth mindset where we are framing our perspective towards a vision of possibility and aspiration to see what else we can do with what we have on hand is a very important approach to shift public perception and to enhance the acceptance of scientific innovation in food. So the key appreciative strategies really is about reframing the problem, but into possibilities and looking at threats as opportunities. Just that shifting in the terminology makes a big difference. Then you see the strengths and the successes of what's worked. And when you do that, you're actually increasing their curiosity. You're removing judgment. And this helps people and systems shift their paradigm from a deficit-based perspective to a growth or strength-based perspective.
Some people would say that we're already, as consumers, we're swimming in information. We're swimming in marketing promises that many times are competing. So is the issue that we're not using the right language to communicate, or that we're not prioritizing the right messages?
I think it comes down to understanding what consumers value most and being able to talk along those lines. So we may be presenting information a certain way, but if a consumer need is in a different plane, we will never, never resonate. So what we need is to see, what are they looking at? They're typically looking at Is it nutritious? But there is also a general prevailing perspective, not only in the US, but around the world, that if it's good for me, it must taste awful. So how do we also convey it's nutritious, but tastes good? And most importantly, it's safe. Safety is a very important reason. Those are the only three that matter. Affordability, convenience, all of that, you know, are the tickets to the game, but these are the three, you know, non-negotiable aspects of food. So how do we convey that without seeming like a propaganda, but talking in very finite terms so they get it? That's really what it, people get that oranges and lemons are good for vitamin C. They get it. Why haven't we done this with other foods? Why haven't we done this with our technologies?
So walk us through the five D's of appreciative inquiry. How does this work? And how can this specifically be applied to food development?
The five D's stand for define, discover, dream, design, and deploy. Let me explain. So when you're defining the desired outcome. What is it you would like to happen with this new technology or this new food? Well, that means you have to discover. You have to identify the key strong points. What is it that is positive, that builds on strength, and how do we shift from what's wrong to what's strong? So then we dream, once you've discovered all these elements, we are dreaming, we're actually envisioning potential applications. Where all can these strengths be applied? Which categories of food, which types of food, which types of manufacturing, which types of industries? Once we get that, so we've defined it, we've discovered what's good, what are the key strong points, we've envisioned the potential applications, we now innovate and leverage that strength. That's where we are designing it and fitting it into either our food product or into our system, into our manufacturing process. Once we get it, we now have an idea of something that is now better because we've added elements of strength into it. The next part is the deploying part, which is typically what we would call launching or implementation. But the deployment part has a slight difference when it comes to appreciative inquiry. We do this by explaining to consumers, to our ultimate audience, what is the strength? What are the key elements? What are the positive elements of this particular new product or new process that we've got on hand in such a way that it resonates with them, because that's what they're looking for. Even when people are in pain, they are not so much looking for pain relief, but as in something that'll make them much better. So that's what we're employing.
So above and beyond being a communication opportunity or even a marketing opportunity, does appreciative inquiry potentially inform other aspects of product development?
There's a lot of storytelling and communication art and skill that comes into appreciative inquiry. You can only do that if you understand your stakeholders' perspective. Because when you understand through open dialogue and active listening, you've identified their values, their aspirations. So now, instead of focusing solely on the technical aspect of that food innovation, food scientists can actually emphasize the positive aspects and the benefits that these innovations bring to individuals, to communities, to the environment, etc. So this could include, say, improvement in nutrition, sustainability, food safety, affordability, accessibility, convenience. All of these are great stories. Stories have the power to resonate emotionally with people and can help bridge the gap between scientific knowledge and public perception. So if you highlight real-life examples of how food innovation has improved the life or has addressed some pressing challenges, you're actually building a relationship and trust.
Kantha Shelke is principal at Corvus Blue, where she consults on competitive intelligence, new product and technology innovation, and rapid commercialization of healthful foods and food ingredients. She's also a senior lecturer at Johns Hopkins University. Check out her dialogue essay on the appreciative approach in the March issue of Food Technology. And IFT members can engage in an interactive discussion on this topic on the IFT Connect online forum.
Thank you to this episode's sponsor, IFT's Global Food Traceability Center. Get ahead of FDA's Food Traceability Rule January 2026 compliance deadline with the Enterprise Traceability Education Suite, your one-stop resource for comprehensive traceability training. Empower your workforce with this efficient and cost-effective training tool at www.ift.org/traceability.
And that wraps up this episode of Omnivore. Thanks again to all our guests and my colleagues at Food Technology. Omnivore is produced and distributed by the Institute of Food Technologists. If you enjoyed today's show and want to learn more about Food Technology Magazine or how to join the conversation by becoming an IFT member, visit ift.org/membership. For more in-depth discussion about innovation in the science of food, check out IFT's other podcast, SciDish, on the News and Publications page of ift.org. If you have comments or suggestions for future shows, just send us an email. The address is editors@ift.org. For the entire team at Food Technology and IFT, I'm Bill McDowell. Thanks for listening, and join us again for our next episode. This is Omnivore.